everyone. My name is Noman Uzzer. I've been practicing immigration law in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for about 10 years. I've been selected as a Texas Rising Star by Texas Super Lawyers magazine for each of the last 4 years. So this CLE that I'm going to be discussing today and I'm going to be going over is going to be a basic primer on immigration law. I'm going to cover a few important aspects of immigration law, primarily the basics of employment immigration law, family immigration law, and citizenship and naturalization. The last few months, immigration law has actually been a very hot topic, especially with all the changes the new administration is undertaking. But like I mentioned, this CLE really won't go into the very specifics of immigration law. It's going to be more nuts and bolts. So let's dive in. So the first area of immigration law that we're going to go over is family-based immigration. And when you think about family-based immigration, what you're really thinking about first and foremost is, what family members can I petition for, and in what classification am I eligible to petition for them in? So there are two primary classifications for immigration purposes. That is a lawful permanent resident, otherwise known as a green card, and a United States citizen. Depending on your classification, whether you're a lawful permanent resident or a United States citizen, that will dictate who you can file for and how long it will take for that person to arrive in the United States. So as a lawful permanent resident, you can only file for two classifications of individuals. That is your spouses and your children. As a U.S. citizen, however, you can file for your spouses and children, but you can also file for your parents and your siblings, that is your brothers and sisters. So the people that you cannot file for are people like your grandparents, your grandchildren, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins, etc. You're only eligible to file for your parents, your direct children, your siblings, and your spouses. But it goes beyond that, because if you're a permanent resident, the wait times are naturally going to be longer versus if you're a U.S. citizen. So for example, let's say you're a permanent resident and you want to file for your spouse. Well, visas are not available for you, so you have to wait right now approximately 2 years before you can file for your spouse. Whereas if you're a U.S. citizen and you wanted to file for your spouse, visas are available, so it would take about 1 year. But those are quick applications. There's also waiting times for filing for your brothers or sisters, which happen to be the longest waiting categories. So if you're a U.S. citizen and you wanted to, let's say, file for your brother who lives in Canada, and he was born in Canada, the wait times would be approximately 13 to 14 years. There's an oftentimes misconception that you can, as a U.S. citizen, file for any family member and they can come here quickly. That's actually not the case. There's millions and millions of people waiting for visas, especially in the preference category of siblings. And it's even more acute if you're filing for somebody from Mexico or Philippines. For whatever reason, those countries have significantly backlogged visa categories because so many people are trying to immigrate from those countries. So if you're a U.S. citizen and you want to petition your brother, and your brother was born in Mexico, it would take about 20 years before that visa would mature and they could come to the United States as a permanent resident. If your brother was born in the Philippines, it would take about 30 years before they could come to the United States. But for all other countries, it's about 10 to 15 years before siblings can come. There's also different classifications for children. If you're filing for your married children versus your unmarried children. So for example, as a permanent resident, you cannot file for your married children. You can only file for your unmarried children. If your unmarried children are under 21, it takes about 2 years. If your unmarried children are over 21, it takes about 5 to 7 years. That's for permanent residents. For U.S. citizens, you can file for your married children, but it'll take about 10 to 12 years before they can immigrate. And if you file for your unmarried children, it's still about 7 to 8 years. But all these different visa categories can be found in the visa bulletin. So if you want to know what category somebody can file under and how long it takes to file, you can just Google State Department Visa Bulletin and you can see the different categories. They're outlined there. It's basically like a table with a matrix. And so it has certain categories. So like you'll see F2A, that's for spouses and children of permanent residents, or F4, that's for siblings of U.S. citizens. And the visa bulletin will spell out what categories designate what symbols, and then you'll see what the wait times are based on the country of chargeability. So, like, and that's basically country of birth. So if your relative was born in XYZ country, you will just look at the category and then scroll over to the right and then see how long it'll take for them to come. But that's basically the underlying idea of family-based immigration, in the sense of who you can file for and how long it takes for those people to come. So once again, I would like to encourage all the listeners out there, if you have more questions about this particular area, I would encourage you to Google Visa Bulletin or State Department Visa Bulletin, and the first tip that comes up should be from the State Department, and you can read a little bit more about how the Visa Bulletin works, wait times, etc. But moving on, let's say you filed for somebody, let's say you filed for your spouse, and they are living in Germany, and you are a U.S. citizen. Then the question is, you know, how do I bring them over? What's the wait time? How much does it cost? What is the general process? Well, that procedure where you are filing for somebody and they're living in a foreign country and they're intending to immigrate to the United States, that process is called consular processing, because you're processing the case through a foreign U.S. embassy or consulate. So that process begins by filing an application called an I-130 petition, which is Petition for Alien Relatives. That application used to be only 2 pages, but recently USCIS updated their forms, and by recently I mean in December of 2016, so just less than a year ago they updated their forms. So that application is a little bit more comprehensive. I think it's about 8 pages now. But anyway, we're taking the example of you as a U.S. citizen wanting to petition your spouse who lives in Germany. So you file that initial I-130 application in the United States with USCIS. The filing fees for that application are $535. And in addition to the form and the filing fee, there's a number of supporting evidence that you must send with that application. So that supporting evidence will be things like proof of your U.S. citizenship, proof of your wife's identity, so that will be things like a copy of the biographical page of a passport, a copy of her birth certificate. You'll want to send a copy of the marriage certificate to establish that you two are legitimately married, and that marriage is recognized by a state. And one important distinction here, and that a lot of people have questions on, is what if me and my spouse have a religious marriage? Well, in the United States, religious marriages are not recognized. The only marriages that are recognized are marriages that are civil ceremonies, that happen when you apply for a marriage certificate to the local county courthouse. If you get married in another country, and that country recognizes religious marriages as legal marriages, well, then the United States will honor that religious marriage, so long as it's recognized by the foreign country. So you want to make sure that you have a marriage certificate that is recognized by the country wherever the marriage took place. Also, another key important fact is foreign language documents. If your marriage certificate or your family member's birth certificates are in a foreign language, those have to be translated. They have to be translated to English, and the translation has to be a certified translation. And what that means is that whoever translating it has to verify that they are able to translate a document from one language to another, and from that language, from English back to that language. They're competent to read and write in that language, and can verify the authenticity of the translation. Most people go through translation companies to get documents certified. It's usually not that expensive in the U.S., and then it's especially cheaper in foreign countries. At any rate, in addition to those civil documents that I mentioned, you also want to send 2 passport-style photos. Those are photos that are 2 inches by 2 inches with a white background. with that application. And of course, proof of the relationship. So in this instance, we're talking about when you're filing for your spouse, so you would want to send things like proof that you've met recently, so copies of your passport if you visited there, plane tickets, photos from the trip, any kind of itineraries for travel, hotel receipts, car rentals, etc. And so these are things that you want to advise your client if they come to you and they say, hey, I just got married, my wife is living in XYZ country, how do we begin this process? Well, you want to say, first of all, well, the initial application is called an I-130 that we need to file. The filing fees are $535, and this is a checklist of all the documentation that we'll need in order to file that application. So let's say they've provided you the documents, they've given you the information to complete the form, and then you file the application with USCIS, that's United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. Then you're pretty much done for the time being. That application will then be processed by USCIS and ultimately adjudicated by an officer. It'll take about anywhere from 6 to 8 months to adjudicate that application if you're a U.S. citizen applying for your spouse. Once that application is adjudicated and approved, the file will then be transferred to the National Visa Center. The National Visa Center is the second step in this immigrant visa processing, otherwise known as consular processing. The National Visa Center will then require some additional documentation. They'll require the same kind of documentation that was just sent to USCIS, like copies of the marriage certificate, birth certificate, citizenship certificates, things like that. But they'll also require the foreign applicant's police clearance letter. And this can be a little bit tricky, because the National Visa Center requires police clearance letters from any country an applicant has lived in for longer than 6 months after the age of 16. So in this example, if your client is filing for their wife who's living in Germany, but she has spent 2 years studying in London and 2 years studying in Egypt after the age of 16, then she'll need to obtain police clearance letters from all those countries, from Egypt, from the UK, and from the country that she's living in, Germany. And once again, the State Department provides instructions on how to obtain police clearance letters if you're living in a country, or if you're living in another country but have previously lived in that country and need to request a police clearance letter. So that information can be obtained by Googling State Department Visa Reciprocity Schedules. That's reciprocity schedules. So what you would do is you would click on a country. So let's say you're living in England and you need to get a police clearance letter from Egypt. Well, you would click on Egypt, and then you would click on police clearance letters, and there would be a couple paragraphs explaining if you're residing in Egypt, this is the place in Cairo that you need to go to get the police clearance letters. Or if you're residing outside of the country, this is the mailing address that you need to send documentation to in order to obtain a police clearance letter. And so that information can be very helpful because you can just copy and paste it and send it to your client and say, hey, this is where you need to go for your wife to obtain her police clearance letter in that country that she lived in for a couple years while she was studying. And once again, that is the reciprocity table. So if you Google State Department reciprocity tables, that link should come up, and it should be pretty self-explanatory about how to, you know, navigate through it in order to obtain the foreign civil documents you need. But beyond police clearance letters, the National Visa Center will also require an affidavit of support. And that's a form that needs to be completed. It's called an I-864 Affidavit of Support form. And that's basically when you're saying that you are being not only the sponsor for your wife, but the financial sponsor. And the financial sponsor is the financial sponsorship requirement is basically a declaration to the government where you are saying, hey, I'm sponsoring this foreign person. If at any point this person gets federal benefits from the government or becomes a public charge on the government in some way, the government is within their rights to ask me to reimburse them. So if your client brings her wife over, and then a few years later, she goes on welfare, or she goes on food stamps. Because you signed that I-864, affidavit support sponsorship, the government would be within the rights to come back and ask you to reimburse them for providing public assistance to your wife. And this is a common issue because a lot of times people don't have sufficient income to qualify to be the financial sponsor. For example, if you're going to school, if your client is a student, they're pursuing, let's say, a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, and they marry somebody in a foreign country, they don't have the sufficient income to sponsor them based on the poverty guidelines. So kind of backtracking, in order to sponsor somebody, you have to earn a certain income, which is dictated by the poverty guidelines. And that's something else that you could Google. If you just Google IA64 poverty guideline, it should take you to the USCIS website where you can download the forms, and it will kind of spell out what the minimum income requirements are based on your household size. But if you're a student and you have no dependents and you want to sponsor your wife, the minimum income is about $21,000 annually. And you're likely not making that if you're a full-time student. So what do you do? Well, you have to get a joint sponsor. That's somebody else who's a permanent resident or a U.S. citizen that's willing to take on the financial sponsorship requirement and the financial sponsorship obligation. So that person will provide their sponsorship in lieu of yours. And a lot of times that's just a family member, like an older brother who's working or parents who are working. They generally step in and help out the family member who's petitioning their relative. But at any rate, the National Visa Center will require an affidavit of support from the petitioner, and if that petitioner needs a joint sponsor, they'll require from the joint sponsor as well, police clearance letters from every country that your relative has lived in for more than 6 months after the age of 16, the civil documents that we talked about previously, and then you'll also pay some additional fees to the National Visa Center, or your client will, and those fees will be paid online. They're about $325 and $120. There's two separate fees. One is called an immigrant visa fee, and one is called an affidavit of support fee. And those are the fees the State Department charges to review the documentation. So you'll send that second round of documentation to the National Visa Center, and they will take about 2 to 3 months to review it. During that time, they'll also ask your client to complete a form called a DS-260. DS stands for Department of State. So Department of State Form 260. Once the fees have been paid online at the National Visa Center stage, you can log in and complete that DS-260 application on behalf of your client, assuming they provided you all the details of their family member's personal information. So you'll complete that DS-260 generally while the National Visa Center is reviewing the civil documentation. If the National Visa Center comes back and says, okay, you provided us everything we need, now we can schedule your family member for an interview at the U.S. Embassy. So this is when they will transfer the file from the National Visa Center, which is in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, to the U.S. Embassy abroad. So in this example that we're talking about, it's a situation where your client is married to a U.S. citizen who lives in Germany. So if they're a German citizen, then the client will be sent to the U.S. Embassy in Frankfurt. If they're not a German citizen, if they just happen to be living in Germany because they're studying there, when in actuality they're a citizen of France, then the National Visa Center will either send the file to the U.S. Embassy in Paris, or if the U.S. Embassy in Germany processes third-party nationals, that is to say, somebody who is not a citizen of that country, they're a citizen of another country seeking to come to the United States, then they're a third-party national in that country, and some countries will process third-party nationals depending on their legal status in that third country. So if they're a citizen of Germany, then they'll process in Frankfurt, Germany, if they're living there. But if they're a citizen of France living in Germany, and let's say they have permanent resident status in Germany, then they'll likely process in Germany. But if they only have temporary status in Germany, the National Visa Center will likely say, well, they got to process in their home country, which is in France, so they got to go to the U.S. Embassy in Paris. So at any rate, once the National Visa Center approves the case and designates the foreign embassy abroad, then your client's family member will go to that foreign embassy for their immigrant visa interview. And that usually happens within a couple months. So it takes about 6 to 8 weeks for the file to be transferred from the visa center to the embassy where your client's family member will go to the embassy for the interview. And immigrant visa interviews are generally straightforward. You show up to the interview, you provide the documents. Before the interview, you have to get a medical exam because that's another admissibility requirement. You have to prove that you don't have, or your client's family member doesn't have a communicable disease, and that's typically tuberculosis and hepatitis. Those are the two primary diseases that foreign doctors are testing for. But anyway, your client's family member will undergo a medical exam, and the embassy will designate certain doctors that they can go to for the medical exam, and those doctors will then send the medical results to the embassy for the interview. They'll have to complete fingerprinting before the embassy so they can run additional background checks. Then your client's family member will go to the interview. Interviews are usually straightforward. If they have all the documentation, if they've been properly guided, then the visa will generally be granted within a few weeks after the interview, and then they'll come to the United States, and their green card will be mailed to them after a couple months. So long story short, this whole process of consular processing takes about 1 year or so. The initial application with USCIS will take, like we discussed, about 6 to 8 months. And then with the National Visa Center, it'll take about 2 to 3 months. And then with the foreign embassy, it'll take another 2 to 3 months. So if everything goes smoothly, you can tell your clients or spouses will be here in about a year. That's if they're U.S. citizens. If they're permanent residents, it's the same kind of process, but it takes about 2 years if they're petitioning their spouse. Because when the kids go to the National Visa Center, it'll sit there for a year before the National Visa Center acts on it because the visas are not available. Similarly, if you're applying for your brother or sister, and like we talked about it, it'll take like 14 to 15 years, you can tell your client the initial I-130 will take about, 6 months to a year to get approved. But then the file will be transferred to the National Visa Center, and the National Visa Center will sit on it for more than a decade until the visa becomes available. Then they'll reach out to the petitioner and advise the petitioner they're ready to process the case. And then you go through, 3-4 months of Visa Center processing, then a couple months of embassy processing. And then once the embassy processing is done, hopefully the visas will be issued shortly after that. A couple key points I wanted to talk about. When your client's family members go to visa interviews, you often get the question of what should they expect, what should they take, what kind of questions will be asked. The questions that will be asked tend to be very general. If it's a spousal petition, it'll be things like, how did you guys meet? What are your future plans? What is your relationship like with your in-laws? What is your spouse's daily schedule? Et cetera, et cetera. And what they're looking for is basically a lot of details from the spouse to kind of establish that the two people talk regularly, they plan a life together. And then, of course, they want to see proof. So things like ongoing communication. So that used to be like email communication and instant messaging conversations. Now a lot of people talk over Skype or through WhatsApp. So you should advise your client if there's any way that they can kind of print their Skype logs or print their WhatsApp conversations, and then their spouse can take them with them to the interview. Obviously, take photographs together. The more photos, the better, especially if there's several people in the photos, like family functions and things like that, or if they've gone on vacations and honeymoons to different countries or taking different trips in those photos as well. In extreme cases, we're talking about extreme cases, if the embassy is not satisfied with the answers or the documentation that was provided, then sometimes what they'll do is they will send out embassy officials to local homes and talk to neighbors and see if these people are really married, if there was a wedding function that happened, or, if people are really siblings, if they know that the person from the U.S. has traveled recently, just to kind of corroborate things. And like I said, those are extreme cases that happens, and there has to be something that kind of tips the embassy official off to believing that maybe something is not right here. But that procedure, like I mentioned, is called consular processing. And that's when you are in the United States and your family member is abroad and you're trying to petition for them to come to the United States. So the next aspect of family-based immigration that I want to talk about is the same kind of general idea, which is that you're petitioning a family member, but
the first verification code is escape. E-S-C-A-P-E. Escape. The first verification code is escape. E-S-C-A-P-E. Please take a moment and write this down.
The facts are a little bit different in that you yourself are in the United States, but your family member is also in the U.S., and your family member has a valid status in the U.S. So let's take the same example where your client is a student, they're a U.S. citizen, and they fall in love with somebody else they go to school with. But that person they've fallen in love with is an international student. Let's say they're an international student from Australia. So they're here on a temporary student visa called an F-1 visa. And if the petitioner is a U.S. citizen, well, then they can undertake a process called adjustment of status, whereby they file the entire green card application at one time in the United States, and everything is processed in the United States without having to go through a foreign embassy. And so, like I mentioned, that process is called adjustment of status. That's where you're in the United States, and you're seeking to adjust your status to become a permanent resident. So that application is filed with USCIS. If it's a marriage-based application, like I described, it's filed with the Lockbox facility in Chicago. And there's several different forms that need to be submitted, and I'm just going to kind of read them out. So the first form, like we previously talked about, is I-130, Petition for Alien Relative. And recently, USCIS added a supplement to that. So you'll submit I-130 plus I-130 Supplement A. Your client's spouse will also submit an I-45 application for permanent residency. And they should also submit an I-765, that's application for work authorization, I-131 application for advanced parole travel document, and then the I-864 form that we previously talked about, which is a financial sponsorship form. So all those forms are submitted to USCIS, along with the supporting documentation that we went over when we talked about consular processing, marriage certificates, birth certificates, financial documentation. So like as a petitioner or the co-sponsor, tax returns, W-2, pay stubs. The beneficiary in this case is an international student. So proof that she entered the country legally, so a copy of her passport, a copy of her entry stamp, copies of her I-20s, so in this case, if they're an international student, they're going to school, so the school has issued a document called an I-20, which verifies that they're currently enrolled and taking classes. Two passport-style photos, those are the two photos, 2 inches by 2 inches with a white background, for both the petitioner and the beneficiary, and filing fees. And USCIS recently increased their filing fees at the end of last year, so the two filing fees for an adjustment of status application like this would be $1,225, that's for the I-45 application, and $535, the I-130 application. The work authorization application and the travel document application are free. Ordinarily, they do have filing fees, but they're free in this example if you're filing one concurrent application for adjustment of status. So, in terms of advising clients on how this process works, what you'll do is you'll advise them of the filing fees, $1,225 and $535, the list of forms, and you need to get their personal biographical information to complete the forms, and the civil documents that we discussed. And then typically what they'll ask you is, well, what is this process like? How long does it take? What are the milestones? What are the steps, etc.? So you want to tell them that, well, right now this process is taking about a year. It used to, by the way, take about 6 months, but in the last year or so, there's been extensive delays in the immigration process, so this process will take about a year. You'll file the initial application with USCIS. After a few weeks, your clients will get receipt notices back confirming the application has been received and processed. About a month or so after that, the beneficiary, the person applying for the green card, will be scheduled for fingerprinting so the government can run their background and check their criminal history. The backgrounds that are run are not like a credit background or to see if they've filed for bankruptcy or anything like that. It's a criminal history background. So they'll run their background against the FBI, CIA databases, and several other databases to check their criminal history. And so that happens within about 6 weeks from the time of filing. Then after about 3 months from the time of filing, the beneficiary will receive their work permit, otherwise known as an EAD card, which stands for Employment Authorization Document, and their travel document, otherwise known as AP, which stands for Advanced Parole, which will allow them to travel if they want to while their application is pending. So those come after about 90 days. The most common questions that clients usually ask is, when can my spouse work? When can they get a driver's license? When can they get a Social Security card? Et cetera, et cetera. And all those things can be obtained after they get the work permit, which, like I mentioned, takes about 90 days from the time that you file. So you should advise your clients after about 90 days, you'll get a work permit. When they get the work permit, then their spouses can apply for a Social Security card, and they can apply for a driver's license and other kinds of things like that. So after the work permit and the travel document are issued, the next step is basically waiting for an interview. Like I mentioned, it's taking now about 10 or 11 months to get an interview. That's in Dallas. There are several USCIS offices around the country. In Dallas, it's taking about 10 or 11 months. Once that interview is scheduled, your clients will appear at the interview. If it's a marriage-based case, the things that they'll want to take with them are proof of the relationship. So that's things like joint bank statements, joint lease agreements, joint insurance, joint bills, photographs together, things like that. On marriage-based green card cases, interviews are relatively casual. If you're taking a case, I'm sure that you know your clients will have assured you that the marriage is real and in good faith, and so it should be pretty clear to the officer that the case is a straightforward case. And so they'll ask some basic questions, like they'll ask the beneficiary, "How did you enter the United States?" They'll verify her entries. They'll ask, you know, what status are you in? What is your spouse's date of birth? What are your spouse's parents' names? Where was your spouse born? And vice versa. Then they'll ask some basic questions. How did you meet? Why did you decide to get married? What are your future plans? And then that's when, you know, your clients will show them the documentation that supports their marriage. And so they'll kind of flip through the wedding albums or other albums and look at photos and keep some for the file. Then ask some general questions. It's typically casual. It's not like what your clients may have seen on TV and things like that, what's in the movies. One kind of helpful pointer I want to advise new attorneys out there of is being very careful of people who come to your office and want to apply for a green card based on a recent marriage when you may have some suspicions that the marriage is not real and in good faith. So, as some of you may know, if you are out of status, regardless of how long you're out of status, and you are married to a U.S. citizen, that's one of the few ways that you can get back into immigration status. So a lot of times when people are out of status for several years, but they came legally, they just overstayed their visa, and they marry a U.S. citizen, that's how they can get a green card. So unfortunately, people kind of use that immigration avenue as a way, or as a means to conduct a fraud marriage in order to get a green card. So as a new attorney, it's very important to look for kind of points that would give you the impression that a marriage may not be real and may not be in good faith. And so I'm going to give some examples here. I'm not saying that if any of your clients do this, that the marriage is fake or fraudulent or a sham, but they're just kind of helpful pointers, so that if you see enough of these factors, you should maybe kind of grill your clients a little bit more to make sure that the marriage is real and in good faith. So one of them is, and this is just in my practice experience, if the beneficiary, that is the person who wants to apply for a green card, comes to your office by themselves. They don't come with their spouse. They just come by themselves and they say, "Hey, I recently got married. I want to apply for a green card." The first question you should ask is, "Well, where is your spouse? He or she has to file for you. So why aren't they here with you right now, inquiring about this process that they're about to undertake with you?" Because generally speaking, this is a very important process, and when couples get married, this is something that they both want to learn about, because they both have to undertake it, they both have to be questioned by USCIS, and so it's something that they'll generally do together. They'll come to an attorney's office together. Sometimes they'll bring family members, they'll bring their parents, their in-laws, because they'll want to know about the immigration process too, to make sure everything goes smoothly, because they've invested in this because their children are getting married, etc. So if somebody comes by themselves and it's the beneficiary, you'll want to ask where the petitioner is. And some other important questions you want to ask is, you want to ask what job the petitioner has. And the reason why that's important is because, like we've talked about, the petitioner has to have a certain income level. They got to meet the poverty guideline requirement. And if they don't meet it, you want to ask what kind of job they have and why don't they meet those requirements. Because what the government will look for is, if the petitioner, that's the person who's a U.S. citizen, if there's somebody who has previously obtained public benefits from the government, that's somebody who maybe has been living off welfare or Social Security or doesn't have a lot of income, then that's the kind of person that's more inclined to accept money to engage in a sham marriage. And so you want to find out what the financial position is of the petitioner to see if there's somebody who may be inclined to engage in a fake marriage. And I'm not saying that if somebody's poor, they're going to engage in a fake marriage or that they're not earning enough. There could be several circumstances which could dictate somebody not having enough income. I'm just giving an example. And so these are the things that you kind of want to put together just to kind of be a little bit more shrewd as an attorney. You also want to ask if either the petitioner or the beneficiary has a criminal history. Now, technically, only the beneficiary, the person applying for a green card, has to demonstrate that they are not inadmissible, that is to say that they don't have a serious criminal record, they haven't been convicted of a felony. The petitioner's criminal history doesn't preclude the beneficiary from getting a green card, but it's important to you as the attorney to know, to find out what kind of person they are, so that you can, if you need to put some clues together that maybe the marriage is not real, that's something that you just want to ask if some of the other factors are present. But I don't want to talk too much about that. I just kind of want to give some helpful pointers because not every case is straightforward, and not every client will be direct with you. Sometimes clients will not be honest with you or hide facts from you, and so as an attorney, you know, in law school, I'm sure many of us went through client counseling where you kind of have to ask several questions to your clients to make sure that they are providing you all the relevant facts so that you can properly guide them. And they may hide stuff from you. And so as a shrewd attorney, it's important to kind of get at some of those points in the cases that they may want to hide from you so that you can decide if it's a case that you feel comfortable with, if it's a case that you actually want to take. And certainly if you feel like it's not a real case, then you should decline it right away. It's not worth it to take those kinds of cases. But beyond that, that's basically the family-based immigration process that I wanted to cover. Like we discussed, just to recap, if your family member is overseas, then you do a process called consular processing, where you file an initial I-130, you wait for the visa to become available, then you process through the National Visa Center, then ultimately the Foreign Embassy. If your family member is in the United States and in status, and the visa is available, then you do a process called adjustment of status, and you file those forms and documentation with USCIS. You wait about a year, you go through the process, and it ultimately concludes with an interview. And if the immigration officer is satisfied at the end of the interview, then they'll likely approve the green card shortly thereafter. But let's move on to employment-based immigration law. And so that's the other area of immigration law I wanted to discuss. And so there are basically two types of employment-based immigration law that I want to talk about. One is non-immigrant visas. So a non-immigrant visa is a temporary work visa or a temporary visa to live in the United States. And then there are immigrant visas. So in the employment-based green card process, an immigrant visa is something that you obtain after your employer sponsors you for a green card. So in the context of non-immigrant visas, there's a few that I want to discuss, and the four most common non-immigrant visas that I'll be discussing are an L-1, an E-2, that's L as in labor, E as in employment, H-1B, H as in house, and F-1, F as in family. So the L-1 visa, there are two kinds of L-1 visas. There's L1A and L1B. L1A is for international executives and managers. That's somebody in a foreign country that is an executive or manager. That is to say, they are somebody who is overseeing the work of other professionals. They're in a company that has, you know, maybe several hundred employees. And they're not overseeing all those hundreds of employees, but they have a group of maybe at least 5 or 10 employees that they're overseeing. So they are overseeing professionals, and they are in a foreign country, and they are being transferred to the United States to work for the same company, but a subsidiary or an affiliate of the same company. And so that kind of visa is an L1A. It's for international executives and managers, and it can be obtained for a maximum of 7 years. One of the main benefits about an L1A visa is that after having it for 1 year, your company can sponsor, or your client's company can sponsor your client for a green card. And so, like I said, that's an L1A visa. Some important factors to consider on an L1A visa is that when you come to the United States, you have to work in an L1A capacity for a year, if it's a new business, before a company can sponsor you for a green card. And the max duration time on an L1A is 7 years. So L1As are sought-after visas, but they're really for high-level international executives and managers. An example would be something like, let's say, a company like Toyota has a major plant in Japan, and they want to open up a new plant, or they have a plant in the United States, and they want to transfer one or two of their high-level executives from their plant in Japan to run or oversee the work that's being done in the United States. You're talking about a company that has offices throughout the world, but at the very least, they have an office in a foreign company, and they have an office in the U.S., and they want to transfer one of their foreign workers, one of their foreign executives, to the U.S. to help run and manage the U.S. company. The second kind of L-1 visa is an L-1B. And an L-1B visa is for people with specialized knowledge. And that's valid for 5 years. On an L-1B, you cannot directly apply for a green card like you can on an L-1A. So on an L-1B visa, it's a situation where, let's say there's a company in Sri Lanka, and they have some really good computer scientists, computer software engineers that have specialized knowledge in that field. Now, they're not executives and managers, but they have very specialized knowledge in coding. And so they want to transfer them to a U.S. office that they have an affiliate with or subsidiary with or division of them, and they want to help do coding there. Well, they would be transferred on an L-1B visa because of their specialized knowledge. And so those are the two types of L visas, L-1A and L-1B. One of the most common non-immigrant visas is an E-2 visa. And so that is an investor visa. And there are two kinds of investor visas. There's the E-2 visa, which I'm going to talk about. And there's also the EB-5 investor visa, which we won't be covering. And the EB-5 investor visa is where you invest at least $1 million in a new or existing business. And that's an avenue to obtain a green card through investment. The E-2 visa is a temporary non-immigrant visa that's valid for 2 years. But you can renew it every 2 years, so long as you meet the requirements. So the first question that your clients will likely ask you is, well, I'm here, I want to apply for an investor visa. Can I do it? And so the first thing you want to ask them is, what citizen are you a country of? Because only nationals of certain countries can apply for the E-2 investor visa. If you Google E-2 investor visa country list, you can probably find a list really easily of the countries that qualify. There's like 50 to 75 countries. And the qualification criteria is that those countries have to have an existing treaty with the United States. That's why this visa is often called the treaty trade or treaty investor visa, because it's only eligible for nationals from countries that have existing treaties with the United States. So assuming your client is a citizen of an E-2 eligible country, The next question you want to ask them is, how much are they prepared to invest? And they'll likely ask you, what is the minimum investment amount? And so the government doesn't set a minimum investment amount on an E2 visa. The government says that the minimum investment amount is governed by industry standard. That is to say, whatever it takes to run that kind of business based on the industry. So if you want to run a trucking company, then whatever it would take to invest in order to run a trucking company. So like, for example, purchasing trucks, purchasing inventory, whatever that costs. And that would be different than if you are coming here and let's say you want to run a CPA practice and you want to invest in your own CPA practice. Well, providing a professional service probably requires less of an investment because there's no inventory or there's less inventory. So you have to demonstrate to the government that the investment amount made by your client is consistent with industry standards. But with that said, we usually advise our clients that they should think about investing at least $100,000 into the business because that's the general threshold to make it a strong case. If your client's investing at least $100,000, then the government is more inclined to think that they're very serious and that the investment will be a productive one. Like I mentioned, the E2 visa is valid for 2 years. And then you can renew it every 2 years indefinitely. The unfortunate thing about the E2 visa is that it doesn't create a pathway for a green card. So no matter how many times you renew it, you can never get a green card through the E2 investor visa. Some important criteria that you'll want to advise your client of when applying for an E2 investor visa is you'll want to advise them that first, they have to demonstrate the source of the investment. That is to say, how the money was accumulated. Because the government is obviously very concerned about how foreign money is entering the United States. They want to make sure that the money was secured through legitimate means. So if your client sells property in their home country, and through that sale of property, that money is then transferred to their foreign bank account, and then from the foreign bank account, it's transferred to their U.S. bank account. The government's going to want a paper trail of all that. They're going to want proof that the property that was sold in the foreign country was in their name, how much it was sold for, where that money came for, etc. If your client has saved up money over time from their job, then they're going to want bank statements to show that the money has slowly accumulated in their account, etc. But basically, they're going to want to know the source of the investment, and there has to be a strong paper trail to support the source of the investment. The government's also going to want to see proof of the investment. So you actually have to put the funds at risk. So that is to say, they're going to want to see proof that you have purchased inventory, you've purchased office space. So they're going to want to see receipts of that. They're going to want to see money transfers, things like that. They're going to want to see photos of the inventory that you purchased, the office space that you've rented or purchased, and anything relating to the business that you purchased. They're going to want to see proof of the business existence. And one of the main requirements is not just that your client is running the business, but that the business is producing more than marginal profits. That is to say, the business is producing enough income, enough profits to sustain a household. So, you know, if your client gets an E2 visa for 2 years and they're filing tax returns or business tax returns that show the business is breaking even, it's going to be hard for them to renew that visa the second time around. That business has to be profitable and it has to be producing more than marginal profits. The next employment visa that I want to talk about is an H-1B visa. And this is probably the most common employment-based visa that people are working on in the United States. In order to qualify for an H-1B visa, you have to be working in a professional occupation. That is to say, an occupation that ordinarily requires a bachelor's level degree. And generally, that's people in the IT industry. They usually eat up a lot of the H-1B visas because there's a demand for IT workers in the United States. There are 85,000 H-1B visas available every year, 65,000 for people with bachelor-level degrees, and 20,000 for people with graduate-level degrees. That may seem like a lot, but when you consider that about 250,000 people apply every year, a quarter of a million people apply for H-1B visas every year, your clients only have about a 33% chance of getting randomly selected for the lottery. And then if they're lucky enough to have their petition selected to be reviewed, then they still have to go through another process of actually meeting the requirements, the legal requirements to be approved. And the legal requirements include the employer proving that they actually need the foreign worker to fill the role, that it is a professional occupation, that the foreign worker is qualified for it based on their credentials, etc. H-1B visas are good for a maximum of 6 years, but applicants can renew their H-1B visas in 1- and 3-year increments after 6 years if they can prove that their company...
Buckeye CLE's second verification code is RICE, R-I-C-E, RICE. Buckeye CLE's second verification code is RICE, R-I-C-E, RICE. Please take a moment and write this down.
Has passed certain steps in their employment-based green card process, which I'm going to cover in a few minutes. The next and last employment or non-immigrant visa I want to talk about is an F-1 visa, F as in Frank. And an F-1 visa is for students. So that's people that come here to study at a college or university. And so those people are granted what's called DS, that's duration of status, which means that they can continue to stay and study indefinitely for the duration of their education curriculum. So as long as they are satisfying a complete course load for undergraduate studies, that's 12 hours, for graduate studies, that's 6 hours, then they can continue studying until they complete their degree. Once they complete their degree, they're given an opportunity to work for 12 months. That's called OPT, or Optional Practical Training. If they get a STEM degree, that is, if they get a degree in science, technology, engineering, or math, then they're allowed to work for more than 2 years on OPT. And so that's a huge added benefit for them. So if you have a client who says they're on F1, the first thing that you want to ask them is, you know, are you pursuing a STEM degree so that you can get more than 2 years of work authorization after you complete your degree? Or if they're not pursuing a STEM degree, then they get 1 year of work authorization after completing their degree. But those are the primary non-immigrant visas. So I want to turn to now the employment-based green card process. And that's the process whereby you are representing a company, and that company wants to sponsor one of their workers for a green card. So the company has established a good relationship with one of their workers, and they want to initiate that process to have that foreign worker get a green card. So this process operates in 3 steps. The first is a labor certification. The second is an I-140 petition. And the final step is applying for a green card. That's the I-45 petition. So talking about the labor certification, labor certification is the longest and toughest step in the employment-based green card process. It's a systematic process of recruitment whereby the employer has to test the labor market to demonstrate to the Department of Labor that there are no skilled, able, or qualified U.S. workers. It's not as easy as saying we want to petition somebody. The Department of Labor has set out very specific guidelines that the employer has to show to them that they have fully and in good faith tested the labor market and they have not found a qualified or able U.S. worker. And it's not enough to show that they haven't found anybody better than a foreign worker. They have to show that there's not a single U.S. worker that's able or qualified. So the way the Department of Labor has outlined the requirements is that for a professional occupation, it outlines 3 mandatory forms of recruitment. And then for a professional occupation, there are 3 additional forms of recruitment, of which you have a choice of 10 different avenues you can pick from. So for the mandatory forms of recruitment, the employer is required to first post a job on the state workforce agency website for 30 consecutive days. So in Texas, that's the Texas Workforce Commission website. Every state has a Workforce Commission website. Then they have to post a job in a newspaper of general circulation for 2 consecutive Sundays. So in Dallas, that's the Dallas Morning News, Fort Worth Star-Telegram. So you basically are looking for the largest newspaper in the city, and you got to post a job ad for 2 consecutive Sundays. That's usually the most costly job posting. Then they have to post a job ad internally for 10 consecutive business days. And those are the 3 mandatory forms of recruitment. And then, like I mentioned, for professional occupation, they also have to do 3 supplemental forms of recruitment. And the Department of Labor has given 10 options to do 3 supplemental forms of recruitment. And so that's things like a local or ethnic newspaper, a radio advertisement, an online job posting, posting at a career fair, posting through a referral agency, etc. So once you have helped the employer do all the job postings, that usually takes about 2 to 3 months, then the employer will collect resumes and interview any qualified applicants. If they can't find any qualified U.S. workers, then the employer can submit the labor certification to the Department of Labor, and that's on form ETA 989. The labor certification is also often referred to as a PERM application, P-E-R-M. If after interviewing any workers, the employer decides that there is a skilled, able, or qualified U.S. worker, they can do a second round of interviews, but after that, they still decide that it's a qualified worker and they can't figure out any lawful job-related reasons for refusing that applicant, then they can't proceed anymore. They can't do the labor certification, they can't sponsor the green card because there's a qualified worker that can fill the position. That doesn't mean that they need to hire that person and replace the foreign worker. It just means that they can't continue the sponsorship process anymore. But let's take the example of they haven't found a skilled, able, or qualified U.S. worker. They've completed the recruitment. Then they file that PERM application, the ETA 989, with the Department of Labor. Well, once they've done that, then they're waiting for a decision from the Department of Labor. And right now, it's taking about 5 to 6 months for the Department of Labor to review those applications and get back. So after 5 or 6 months, the Department of Labor will either do one of two things, most likely. They'll either say, yes, we've approved or certified the labor certification, which gives the employer the option now to move to the I-140 stage, or the Department of Labor will say, we need proof that you've done recruitment properly. And so that's called an audit request. And they're very common. 33% of labor certifications are randomly selected for audits. So that's when you will prepare a recruitment report and send it to the Department of Labor, and that recruitment report will provide examples, or not examples, but they'll provide printouts of all the forms of recruitment. So printouts from the website postings, the company postings, the state workforce agency postings, you know, the Sunday newspaper publications, etc. And you'll provide proof of the resumes that were received and an explanation as to why each applicant was not qualified. That explanation should come from the employer. And that's called a recruitment report, and that's submitted in response to an audit from the Department of Labor. But let's say the Department of Labor has approved the case, then your client, the employer, can move to the next step, which is filing the I-140 petition. And there are two main issues in the I-140 petition. Number one, the employer must show that they can pay the foreign worker the appropriate wage. That's called the prevailing wage. And so when you do the labor certification, one of the first things that you'll do is you'll file a request for a prevailing wage from the Department of Labor. It'll take a few months to give it back to you. Well, that wage is very important because at the I-140 stage, the company has to prove that they can pay that prevailing wage. And ultimately, when the foreign worker gets their green card later on down the process, the employer is required to pay them that wage, even if it's higher than they're currently getting paid. They're required to pay them that wage when they get their green card. So that's the employer's burden. So they'll provide things like their financials, their tax returns, things like that, to establish that they can pay the appropriate wage. The foreign worker also has the burden of showing that they're qualified for the position. So if the employer has advertised that they're looking for somebody who has a master's degree with 2 years of experience, then the foreign worker has to provide proof that they have a master's degree. If that master's degree was obtained abroad, then they have to get a foreign education evaluation to demonstrate that their foreign degree is the equivalent of a U.S. degree. Or if that degree is obtained in the United States, then they'll provide a copy of their diploma and a copy of their transcripts to show that they meet the education qualifications. In this example, if 2 years of experience are required, then they'll have to provide job verification letters from their past employers to demonstrate that they have 2 years of work experience. And those job verification letters are important because the work experience has to come after obtaining the highest level of degree required for the position. So if the position requires a master's degree, then they have to have 2 years of experience after the master's degree. It's called progressive experience. And those job verification letters have to be very specific. They have to come on company letterhead. They have to explain exactly what the employee did during the time that they worked there. They have to explain the job duties, the dates of employment, They don't have to mention the wage, but they should mention the job title. And like I mentioned, the dates of employment, that it was full-time employment, the job duties, and of course it has to be signed by a manager or somebody from HR from the company. And so that's how the employer would demonstrate, for example, the experience requirements. If the I-140 is approved and the visa is available, then they can do the adjustment of status process that we previously talked about, where they file the I-485 application and apply for a green card. Generally speaking, in the employment-based immigration process, visas are available. So once the employer clears the first two steps, the labor certification and the I-140, they can then file the adjustment of status application. Unless the foreign worker is from India or China, those two countries have a severe backlog, so they'll be waiting 5, 10, 15 years before they can ultimately file that I-485 application. But that's generally the employment-based immigration process. The last thing I want to discuss is not family-based or employment-based, but it's actually citizenship. And so the citizenship process is a little bit different. So individuals can apply for citizenship when they get permanent residency. So we talked about adjusting status or getting an immigrant visa. So the end result of that is getting a green card, which is the same thing as becoming a permanent resident. So when you're a permanent resident for 5 years, you're then eligible to apply for U.S. citizenship and get the benefits of becoming a U.S. citizen. And so there are some exceptions. Some people can apply after 3 years, if they've been married to a U.S. citizen for the last 3 years, or if they obtained their green card through a program called VAWA, Violence Against Women's Act, V-A-W-A, then they can apply after 3 years. But most people apply after being permanent residents for 5 years. So when you apply for citizenship, there are certain eligibility requirements that you have to demonstrate. First, you have to demonstrate that in the last 5 years, as a permanent resident, you haven't had a single trip of longer than 180 days. You also have to demonstrate that in the last 5 years, you have been living in the United States for at least half the time. So that is 30 out of 60 months, or at least 913 days, without having 912 days abroad. And that's because the government wants to grant citizenship to people who have established ties to the U.S. They've been spending at least half their time in the U.S., and they haven't had extended trips abroad. You also have to demonstrate that you're a person of good moral character. That is to say, in the last 5 years, you have not been convicted of any crimes. And by crimes, that's at least a class A, B, or C misdemeanor. Traffic violations are not considered issues or impediments to citizenship unless you have like 50 traffic tickets or something like that. It's really serious crimes or misdemeanors. And then also you have to demonstrate command of the English language. At the very basic level, that's an elementary knowledge of the English language. You have to pass the civics portion of the exam. So there's 100 questions, and the government officer will ask you 10 questions. You got to get 6 right. You got to be able to read and write English. And you got to be able to converse in English, because the immigration officer will ask your client questions in English, and they'll need to be able to communicate at a very basic level. The government describes it as an elementary knowledge. So when you have a client that wants to apply for citizenship, you want to ask them a few things. First, how long they've been a permanent resident to make sure they're eligible. You want to ask them if they have been arrested in the last 5 years. You want to make sure that they speak English at an elementary level. And you want to ask them about their travel history to make sure they meet the physical and presence travel requirements. That is to say, they haven't had any trips longer than 180 days, and they have spent at least half their time in the U.S. So when you file an application for citizenship, the form that you're filing is called N-400, and you'll attach supporting documentation for your client, like copies of their green card, copies of all pages of their passport, copies of their driver's license and social security card, and you'll mail that to USCIS. And it's the same kind of process. After a few weeks, they'll send a receipt notice to you and your client, then they'll schedule your client for fingerprinting to run their background. And then after about 8 to 10 months, they'll schedule your client for an interview. And the interview is very casual. It's broken up into two parts. The first part is generally where they do the exam, which is very straightforward, where they ask questions, specific questions that your client has to get 6 out of 10 right, and then read a sentence and write a sentence in English. And the second part of the interview, which lasts about 10 minutes, is just reviewing the citizenship application with them and verifying all the information. If there are no impediments to the case, if they meet all the eligibility requirements, then what happens after that is they will be scheduled for a swearing-in ceremony. When they go for the swearing-in ceremony, that's where they get their naturalization certificate and officially become a citizen. And with that, they can apply for a U.S. passport. But that's a very kind of quick analysis of the citizenship process. So as I mentioned, that's basically what I wanted to talk about today. We discussed family-based immigration, employment-based immigration, and citizenship. If you have further questions or more specific questions, you can always feel free to email me or reach out to Esquire. They have my contact information, and they can put you in touch with me. My email address is Noman, N-O-A-M-A-N, at azharlawfirm.com. That's azharlawfirm.com. Once again, that's Noman at azharlawfirm.com. And if you also want to reach me through Esquire, you can contact them, and they can contact me. But that's the end of my CLE. Good luck, everybody. And I hope that you enjoy practicing immigration law.